Welcome to the Procurement Show.
Hello and welcome to the Procurement Show, the show that tackles the topics we all need to think about and sets out to explore the more interesting bits of procurement. I'm Jonathan O'Brien.
And I'm Paul Philpott. My job is to polish the windows on O'Brien Towers, which wouldn't be so bad, but they're 8 stories high.
Yeah, and we're planning a 9th. This week we're talking about gender equality in procurement, and in particular in our supply chains and procurement's responsibility here.
The Procurement Show is brought to you by Positive Purchasing, enabling the future of procurement in organisations around the globe.
To help me, our guest this week has written for magazines and newspapers in the US and Canada, is the author of The Summer House, conceived the first magazine for midlife women, and has held senior editor positions with various magazines. She founded Vitamin W Media, a platform for women's news, business, and philanthropy. And after her career in print journalism, she moved into data journalism. Now, she is the founder of Gender Fair, a public benefit corporation that is all about how companies serve women well. Please welcome to the Procurement Show, Amy Cross. Hello, it's great that you could join us today.
Well, thank you. I love having breakfast in the UK.
Let's start with how are we doing on gender equality at a global level? It's a small question, but I thought that's a good place to start. How are we doing?
Not well. I mean, we're having a big backslide in many, many areas. The right-wing backlash is strong everywhere, and pandemic set us backward. So we really have to work especially hard. And there's a sense of complacency that we have made progress, because you might see a few more high-profile women, but by and large, in many countries, there isn't the progress that we've been hoping for the last few years. And there's even some backsliding on big measures like boards. I mean, I know the data most in the United States, a little bit in Europe, but in the United States, the leadership data for women has not changed. The 5 top paid positions in corporations hasn't moved in like 6 or 7 years. It's only like at 14%, which is also the number of women in high positions in the procurement role. I think it's about 14% of SVPs or VPs in procurement. So these numbers are not moving very well at all. And same for women in management. So we have to, I mean, not we have to, I'm hoping we do work harder to making these better. We have goals. We're not reaching the SDG. But anyway, that's a long answer. So the main message is don't fall asleep. This is work we still want to do for everyone to make the world more efficient and fairer.
And just before we came and did this today, I took a quick look at some of the stats. And you mentioned the United Nations SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals. They have just published their annual summary of 2023, which is quite damning. As you say, it says we are going backwards in terms of all aspects of gender equality, right. All the Sustainable Development Goals, where that is relevant within those. Also, at a global level, for example, one of the things that really stuck in my mind, of the global population that is illiterate in the world, 2/3 of those are women, which is really scary. I think having you on to talk about this today is wonderful, because these are the things that perhaps we're not paying attention to enough, because we perhaps don't realize that we are actually going backwards.
It's such an important topic, because there are so many reasons why this should be figured out. But I guess when we're talking about gender equality in procurement, that's a bit of a simplified term, because we've got the discussion about 2 areas, gender equality in the procurement function, but also gender equality in our supply chain as The challenges can be a bit different. It might be fair to say that we're making a little bit of progress for women in procurement when it comes to big companies, because they like to publish how well they're doing. But also the situation, as you alluded to earlier, Amy, is very different around the world. So can you paint 2 pictures for me, as colourful as you can, about the difference in attitudes across those 2 audiences, but also a little bit about how it varies around the globe?
I don't have a huge global expertise, but I do know, as you said, there's 2 parts of that supply chain, right? There's the people in the factories, offshore factories making things. I can't even see into that. And then there's people working procurement and the companies from which they buy, an indirect procurement. So the thing about the factories worldwide, there are programs such as, like, there's Her Project in the garment industry that Gap and a lot of H&M and a lot of larger clothing manufacturers are working to educate women and have certain kinds of minimum standards in these factories and inspections and controls. And that's good. And so we want that to move forward. And there's also something in the United States called ICRW, mm-hmm. International Center for Research on Women. And they were creating a tool. They wanted, I think, Target and Amazon were using it for their factories to sort of, you know, assess how they're doing, how they're treating their women employees. So I think that's an incredibly important part. And I think, you know, we as consumers can be asking these questions. It's much harder because we can't see into that. Like, there's no label that tells us this was made at a Her Project factory or anything like that. You just know some of the suppliers are working with these groups. And I think even one of the companies we work with, Logitech, they do talk to their factories and try to figure out what the human rights standards are. So this is something I think we can all be aware of. There are women far away making things for us, and we can help them get educated, and we can help them get health projects and things like that in these factories.
Delving a bit deeper into that, because one of the things we've talked about on this show a lot is how you begin to drive sustainability as a sort of big topic in the supply chain, how you're looking at all the aspects of social and environmental responsibility. And it's clear that when you look at a supply chain, that presents the biggest challenge because the suppliers, the people involved, are many contractual steps removed. In other parts of the world where legislation is different, you can't see what happens. And you mentioned that there's some of the programs that are tackling specific industry sectors. But imagine most companies that have lots of supply chains, if there aren't those indicators, where do you start? How do you begin to assess your supply chains for gender equality and to get some sort of measure as to whether you're good, bad, or what you need to tackle first?
Our moniker of gender fair is more for companies and not for the supply chain, but there could be an international standards like there is for fair trade of how you know, we're paying our coffee farmers a fair wage, we're supervising how this the distribution happens. So I would hope that one day maybe the UN or someone will create a standard for all the diverse supply chains. I mean, that's the problem with sustainability too. There's so many different ways to measure it, and there's so many different standards, and it's all very confusing. So this is the same thing is going to happen in gender as well. But I hope that we can work on a global standard for this factory work. It's not the part of the work that I do, but I would love to incorporate it in our measurement, of course. That would be ideal so that you would know. Fair wages. Yeah, this is a goal that we can work toward. But you see how this is still a nascent movement.
Like,
we've talked about women's rights in the West for a long time and certain rights in the workplace, but it hasn't gone very far and isn't very sort of globalized. Like you might say, a lot of people, when they hear that I work in gender in the workplace, they say, well, we're doing great in gender. We have a girl in marketing and we have mat leave. And that's really not enough. So the UN created a tool called the Women Empowerment Principles, and those are great. We'll talk about those later.
I want to pick up on something you just said then. You mentioned consumers. I guess it's fair to say that if consumers only knew the truth and they had full knowledge of what happened within organizations, it would no doubt influence consumer decision making. Yep. And with the example that you just gave, Amy, we've all heard of the term greenwashing.
Yep.
Is there such a thing as gender washing?
Oh, yes. Lots and lots of pink washing. I see it all. We see it all
the washing,
time.
Yeah.
All the time. Pink washing. Yes. Yeah, so they'll do this like nice ad and they'll say like X company, rah, rah, women, rah, rah, women. And then, you know, you see there's no women on the board and there was no maternity leave. And it's like, well, those are dangerous messages to put out because people will now catch them off. The work I do at Gender Fair, that's what we do, is we have this measurement and we can sort of show which companies are actually doing well in gender, which ones aren't. It's quantifiable. And I can tell you later the sort of effects of when they don't do well in gender. But I think there was a Super Bowl commercial a while ago by Audi. And it was like, you know, this man encouraging his daughter, building a race car, and they did this great job. And it was so empowering. And then some of the advertising journalists like looked up the leadership data of this, I think it was Audi at the time, and it was not very good. So she called them out on it. Like, how can you make this $1 million commercial or kajillion dollar commercial for the Super Bowl, which is a high holiday in America, and then not be practicing what you're preaching? So I think now companies are, I hope they're more aware of this. Our hope is to make women realize not everyone's going to care, as you said, about how their products are made. A small percentage will. That percentage is enough to make change, just like the fair trade movement, which started, what, 50 years ago, 60 years ago. It was a small movement, but now it's globally recognized and people can think about it when they buy coffee or sugar and have a little bit more comfort.
And I think it's fair to say we all assume that the companies that we buy from are doing good stuff because we trust those brands. We trust them with our health and we put the stuff inside our bodies and things like that. So we assume that they must be good companies. Otherwise, we wouldn't buy the stuff. So it always comes as a shock when you tell the story that you just told about Audi and actually looking at the board and finding out who's actually on the board. And we're talking the car company here, right?
The car company, that's right. When we first started, we measured Tesla.
Yeah.
We have a 100-point scale, and Tesla got a zero.
Oh, wow.
Which meant there was no public reporting. The public reporting there was, like, the board they have to do, but in the regular, like, just optional reporting that companies do, that from which we take our journalism, there was nothing about women. You search their website, you couldn't even find the word women or gender. And same with Activision, incredibly low score. And then they both are beset by harassment and discrimination scandals. Mm. Companies that don't perform on women, you can tell they're sort of not very happy workplaces for many people.
The Procurement Show, exploring the more interesting bits about procurement. And now, the Procurement Fun Fact. This edition's exciting tale of preposterous procurement, bizarre buying, or simply saucy sourcing.
Benjamin Franklin once said, "The bitterness of poor quality remains long after the sweetness of low price is forgotten."
The Procurement Fun Fact. Contact us by email, hello@theprocurementshow.com. Send us a tweet, @procurementshow, or connect with us on LinkedIn. Search for The Procurement Show.
It's interesting, because I've spent the last 20-something years working all over the world training big companies and done a lot of that training myself. So I've gone into companies and seen a microcosm of those companies and perhaps had 20 or 25 people in a room together. Over the last 20 or 25 years, I've seen huge changes. I can remember doing training with engineering firms, global engineering firms. Everybody in the room was male, typically white, middle-aged male. And now I go in when I do those training events, it's much more balanced. It's not there yet, but it's how I judge that company from the little tiny bit that I see. In retail, for example, it's very balanced, and you get this sense of balance within those companies because it is 50-50, maybe even more women than men in many cases. Yet in other industries, it's still quite slow. And then it varies around the world as well when I've worked in different parts of the world.
Are you lucky in that you've just had experience of organizations recently that are doing it right? Because clearly, that's not the universal situation.
Yeah. And I think maybe it's also something that we're seeing in procurement, that because it's one of these things that it doesn't have some of those traditional stereotypes. Amy, I don't know whether this is fair or not, but when you look at engineering, there are those traditional stereotypes that perhaps means it's slow for women to enter that profession. When you look at procurement, those things aren't there. So it should be that we have everything to make sure that there's equality. I don't know if that's fair, Amy.
That's right. I think that's fair. I looked up the numbers again today. I think 40% of your industry is women. So whereas in the tech industry, it's much smaller, right? It's only 21%. It shrunk since when I was in school. It used to be much larger. For some reason, it shrunk. So that has an opportunity for more fairness. I'm happy to hear that story. And lots of research shows the business case for diverse teams on gender and everything. And so there's a better products, there's better performance. And some companies, even in procurement, do this, like HP for a while. When HP and Microsoft would ask their teams buying advertising, and lawyers would ask for diverse teams to come through. So if you want to give us lawyers or your ad agency, they don't want just the same looking people to deliver legal advice or ads. And HP even did a study after they acquired these diverse teams. This is back in 2016 or 17. Then they researched the ROI of the ads. They could show that not only the ads, you know, were different, and they sold more HP products. These rooms you're in with more diverse people in procurement, there'll be fallout effects from that.
I've experienced that. It's hard for me to put this into words, but there is a balance when you have that. You know, I've worked in lots of companies. I've worked in heavy male-dominated companies. It has an unhealthy feel to it. But when you have that balance, then I can't explain why, but it just works better because there are differences in the way people make decisions, the way people feel, the way people use intuition. Intuition.
I knew you were going to say that.
In something. And it just does something more. Hard to put my finger on it, but it just works better when it's balanced.
Can you give some good examples of where legislation has been applied to fix this problem? Also, the attitude towards legislation globally.
The EU has done really well with quotas. and they've had great board representation because of quotas. Rwanda made quotas in parliament. So I don't think the free market is necessarily always wants to make things fair. So I believe legislation can make a huge difference. Like in the United States, we have very little legislation for these things. So we were slower making progress. So I think there are lots of countries where they're legislating and it makes a difference. And I want to talk about legislation and procurement too, if that's possible. Like in Australia, they've legislated something called the WGEA, the Workforce Gender Equality Administration. And all companies with over 100 employees have to report on these metrics around gender. And it's run by Mary Wooldridge. And that's very exciting. So that's what we do, except the government makes them do it, which is great. And so now, not only do they have these stats of all companies over 100 employees, now in some of the Australian states, there's preference given to suppliers that do well on this measurement, the WGA measurement. It's all public. Anyone can access it. If you want to go look up some bank in Australia, you can go find their gender data on the web. It's easy. And they've just started reporting on pay, too. And that's one that really needs to be legislated. And then in the UK, you do pay, which that creates huge change. The UK led on that. The United States, I think there's only a few companies do the really powerful measurement on pay. When you look at pay globally, you know, men make $100 million at this company and women make $50 million. It shows the high-paying jobs aren't going to women. So the UK is way ahead on that. I hope America, I hope the United States and Canada copy you on that. So anyway, this legislation about procurement is very powerful. And Italy just did this great thing. And I just learned it recently. I wrote a piece about it. They created a certification in that country. It's complicated. It's not simple like ours or the one in Australia. And now companies that do well on this and get certified through this auditing bodies then will be preferred on tenders. And they will be given a discount on social security tax. Like, that's very significant. That's motivational. Not only just legislate, but reward. I'm like, that is the smartest thing. Yeah. Why wouldn't anyone do that? You know, Japan also does preference for tenders of companies that do well in gender, actually. And Mexico also, they have some rules to require tax for practices that reduce gender inequity. Switzerland also. So this is something, if a government cares about trying to create more gender equality for all genders, procurement is one way to achieve that policy. What I love about your field is that it does have so much power, right? I started to work in consumer power. And then this wonderful man, David Latin from Logitech, who is no longer with us, he had this idea to bring it into procurement. Like how much he said, well, these are billions of dollars. He controlled a $1 billion budget. If he starts asking his vendors to do better on gender, they're going to listen more than they will to Amy Willard Cross, you know? A guy with a $1 billion budget has a much bigger voice.
So when we think about how procurement can respond, so we've talked a lot about the procurement function, but when we started touching on the supply chains earlier, we struggled to sort of come up with something on that when we were discussing that. I want to come back to that because driving gender equality in the function is one thing, but then really making that happen back at those factories in those other countries that don't have that legislation, because they may not have the legislation, but our company or the company in question, that's the company sourcing from that territory. You know, those companies need to be doing more, but we're not doing it. Clearly, we're not doing it. So what do you think is stopping us from being able to drive gender equality back up the supply chain? Is it just too difficult or is it something else?
Well, I mean, if you have a $1 billion budget, actually, again, it's not that difficult. For me, it's difficult. If I'm going to buy a sweater that was made in Bangladesh, you know, I can't go and ask at the factory how they're doing. But I think, as you said, people aren't aware. I can't do it, but maybe someone could do a campaign about this and make people care. You have to make people think about this. And we tend not to think about these things, about, you know, where our milk comes from or where our water comes from or where our clothing comes from. So I hope that that consciousness grows and we start thinking more about fairness in all these factories. That's going to have to be a global movement. If all the big suppliers, you know, if Apple and HP and Logitech and H&M and Gap, if everyone requires it and customers demand it, that very famous fire, the Rana fire, that made people take action. And I don't know if it caused enough change, but let's hope we don't have to have more fires to make the consumer say, let's treat these people better. Let's, I'll pay $5 more for a sweater.
But this is the thing though, Amy, isn't it? We're talking about the bigger picture. We've mentioned the influence that consumers have on the whole story. We're used to seeing the fair trade mark on products. Makes you wonder if actually there should be a fair gender trade.
Fair gender, yes.
Stamp of equality or stamp of quality mark with a M-A-R-Q-U-E.
Well, that's so we do. We have a thing called a gender fair mark, and companies such as Procter & Gamble and Logitech and Zoetis and other companies, MasterCard, have used it to indicate that they have met the sort of minimum standard of equality. But, oh my God, that's a huge dream that would go everywhere. It would be a different thing for factories, but it takes so much will to make a change like this and change people's frameworks of thinking. But that would be a dream of mine. I mean, our dream is to one day see it on products. We've talked to Amazon and other people about, you know, making a filter. You don't think about what you can't see. If you can't see the women working at the factory making clothing, or if you can't see the people in the airline that you're riding, whether they treat their people fairly, you're not going to think about it. So all these things bring it to the consciousness. And then, quite frankly, your field of procurement, the people in procurement have so much power. I love seeing how they used it in sustainability, and I hope they continue to do so in issues of gender and diversity and other fairness, because as we say in the United States, money talks, and big money talks louder. And there's lots of movement in ethical procurement, and this is a growing field, and I'm very excited to see that.
This kind of matches a number of conversations we've had before on the procurement show. We've spoken about diversity, both in terms of the colleague arena, but also in terms of the supply chain. Yeah. We've spoken about the green agenda, making the right decisions for the environment. We've spoken about equality of pay.
Yeah.
We're now talking about gender equality. It all comes back to the power that procurement has. So what's the problem here? Does procurement not realize the power that it's got?
It's an interesting thing, because you've got to remember that procurement is there to buy for the business. And they're not procurement suppliers, not procurement's categories. They belong to the business. So this is about procurement's role to engage with the wider business. What is the company setting out to achieve? So part of that is, what is the organization's goals for sustainability, and specifically for gender equality? Because the organization's got to want to do this at a high level. And then how does procurement translate that into what it does? So it's defining the requirements, the business requirements for what it is it's going to source. And that translates to where you're going to get it from. How is the company that's going to supply it organized to do this stuff? What's all the specifications that go along with that, including how sustainable it is, how it's made, and whether it's gender fair, and so on. So procurement's role is to make that happen in the organization. So that's the power it has. Why is it not happening? People haven't been trained. Organizations haven't organized themselves to do it. They're not doing the hard work, the heavy lifting, to understand those supply chains or develop the right relationships with the suppliers. Or they're not prepared to pay for it in some cases, because it doesn't follow that this is going to necessarily be the cheapest option. In time, it will be, but it means you actually have to be prepared to invest in some of that stuff as well. So that's what stops us. But all of those things are easy to fix. They're all organizational issues that can change the world.
It's time to Ask Jonathan.
And today's Ask Jonathan comes from William Dahlstrom, who asks, and I think this is a question about trust. I learned recently that one of our top suppliers has just developed a new innovation, but they didn't talk to us about it and just launched it. Had we known earlier, it could have made a big difference to some of the things we're working on. How do I get my top suppliers to innovate, and how do I make sure they talk to us first?
That's a really good question. And it's one I've heard many times, that there's this kind of arrogance I see in procurement that, well, the suppliers are there to innovate for us, so just go and tell the suppliers to innovate for us. And we're not very good in procurement at driving innovation. When you think about how important innovation is, it is innovation that can set us apart from everybody else. Where does innovation come from? Well, it's rare it comes from within the company. It's rare that there's a team of people with pointed heads that are creating the next thing. Most innovation comes from the supply base. All the big innovations, if you think about things like everything Apple's created, or Tata did a car in India that was $2,000 because they wanted to make it affordable. All of those things come from supply base innovation, from those companies figuring out, how do I go to the supply base who know how to get the bits I want? Steve Jobs was brilliant at that. You know, when he invented the iPod, he was able to say, you know, I need a company that's going to do a flat battery. I need a touch wheel. I need a miniature hard drive like we have in a laptop. You know, he was able to go to suppliers and say, can you make it this way? So innovation comes from the supply base, and suppliers are out there trying to figure out the next thing. So they're innovating, but it doesn't follow if you say, go and innovate for me that they're going to do that. So there's a number of factors here, and this is back to the relationship that we have with those suppliers and why they would want to bring innovation to us. Worked with one company where the CPO said to a supplier, the supplier brought a new thing and they said, this is really good, you know, and the CPO said, well, we expect you to just give us that as part of the relationship. We're not going to pay for it. Of course, you know, why would that supplier come back again? Mm-hmm. So this is about how you have motivated your suppliers to innovate for you or with you. It's also about the degree to which they are going to do this for the world at large or just for you. If it's just for you working together, that is a unique collaborative position that you have to grow and nurture. If you've done no groundwork, you're not going to get that. What you might get is a supplier saying, hey, we've developed this thing, but they're also saying that to all their other customers as well. You know, when we have meetings with those suppliers, we need to be asking those questions. But if it's just a question in a supplier review meeting and then we do nothing with it, it's pretty pointless. So the answer is that you've got to have the relationship with the supplier and you've got to be openly talking about these things and helping facilitate the supplier to innovate for you and showing them the value that they will get if they do that with you, if you get some sort of exclusivity or preference as a result of it.
Excellent. And when it comes to innovators, other shaped heads are available.
Ask Jonathan. Email your question to jonathan@theprocurementshow.com. You might be part of the next show. The Procurement Show. The latest thinking, the greatest insights.
David Latton, the man who created this coalition for gender fair procurement and who died tragically this summer, he said, you know, he didn't want to just be saving pennies for the man. He wanted to do something with his job. And of course, he worked very hard to build this coalition and bring people on board, such as Salesforce and Zoetis and Andela. But he didn't find it contradictory to his main function. That's what he would say about you. It's easy to apply a lens of fairness on your suppliers. It doesn't really cost much. You know, you ask them some questions. We had a survey that we're giving them, and now we're going to start publishing the data on B2B suppliers and how they do on gender and embed it in procurement platforms. So it's easy to use. And so then it's just, once it becomes more like sort of conversational, it'll be easier to do. I mean, we don't want to make it harder for people, and they can still bargain for prices. At least that might be a data point they can use in consideration, and it won't be a really difficult thing to do. That's our plan.
Is there a return on investment here? If companies pursue gender equality, not only in the function, but throughout the supply chain as well, can we get benefits? Can we get a return on investment because we've done that?
I couldn't speak to that, but what I could say is that sometimes I say to people, it's low-cost CSR. Like maybe you spend $1 million donating to women's groups and this and trying to help women and paying all this, but if you could easily, just by putting a little bit of a gender lens on some of your suppliers, not all of them, and asking all of them to do better on gender or choosing ones that, you know, are do well on gender, that's a way to carry through that policy through all aspects of your organization, right? Why have the value of equality be stuck in HR when it can also be part of procurement? Mm-hmm. It really isn't that heavy of a lift. And I would hope that it would actually help them reputationally, it would help their employees feel good about it, that they're doing business with companies that have the same values they do.
Yeah, I think that is the real benefit. Hard to sort of say, well, there's a financial investment if the factory that we're sourcing from has gender equality. Hard to do that. And that's the risk when we try and boil these things down to something that appeases the accountants who want to see a number. Actually, this is much more than that. By doing this, is this something that is going to make people see and value the proposition that we have much, much more and want to buy from us and think highly of our brand? Because that drives the financial stuff down the line, but it's how consumers respond to that particular brand. So I think what we're seeing here is a redefinition of how people understand the brand values of an organization. Because once we kind of took it for granted because we saw an advertisement on TV and we thought it must be good. But these days, there's no such thing as a mouse potato, which means that people have to understand the brand values in some other way.
But also, there's a bit of a disconnect here, because in this very conversation, you've spoken about the fact that it might cost more, and that is inhibiting progress. And then Amy said it doesn't necessarily need to have a difference in costs. So where is this disconnect? Who's right and who's wrong here?
I think it doesn't need to cost more, but I think right now what I'm seeing is it does cost more. And not just in terms of gender equality, but in terms of dealing with child labor and dealing with forced labor, because companies have had it so easy for so long, have had supply chains where what actually happens when the stuff gets picked or processed, you know, in some dark place, and there's intermediaries in the way that mean that we conveniently can't see that, because that's been well established. When somebody comes along and says, actually, hey, I want to make sure everybody's paid, we can't have children, and actually we need gender equality, then those producers say, well, you can have that, but you're going to have to pay more. And we all know that if you pay more at the supermarket, at the factory here in the UK or the US, that money doesn't get back to where the people are doing the stuff. So you have to go right back to those original farmsteads, those original sources of supply, those original factories, and you have to be able to make sure you know who's working there, how they're paid, and see everything that they're doing. There is no shortcut here. And that's the same for gender, it's the same for race, it's the same for forced and child labour, and so on.
But it does seem as though there's the risk of achieving one thing at the detriment of something else. There are a lot of things to get right in this list of things that you'd like to have happen. It's quite a dark scenario. You've got a situation whereby the conversation that's the loudest conversation gets the biggest audience. So, Amy, do you think that there's a risk that the importance of gender equality is getting pushed aside in favour of these other conversations that we're having?
Yes. Absolutely. The culture typically likes to forget about women and just think they're fine and not make change, because I'm hoping that women start standing up for themselves and having a sense of what they can ask for themselves or for the people making their products. So we have to just advocate for ourselves. It's easy to sort of be complacent. And in the United States, there's a group called the Human Rights Campaign. They wanted to change policies for LGBTQ people in the United States, and they created an index like ours, publish it, and they've created change in 1,500 companies. 800 companies have a perfect score in how they treat the gay population. And so that's just by one organization, 15 years measuring, publishing, and telling companies next year we're going to add this benefit. So I think that the more we call attention to these things, the more we can not let them forget. And I think people do want an equal world. It's just we forget to take action. We become complacent. Even in procurement, you talked about you would lose money. Say, but if you're running procurement for a big company, just choose an airline. You could choose an airline that's gender fair, or you could choose an airline that doesn't do well. But you're not going to really save that much money on one airline versus another, are you? I mean, would you?
No, not really. These days, the world of procurement isn't about savings. 20 years ago, that was the only game in town. Now, it's about, can we get the stuff? And that plays into gender equality and sustainability. Because if you haven't got the right workforce doing the right things, you know, you have a risk there. But it's also about, is it sustainable? So it's about, can we get it? Is it sustainable? And those are the big issues that organizations are grappling with right now. But Amy, you've said throughout this conversation that, you know, you're not a procurement person, and I want to pretend you are for just a moment. You're the chief procurement officer right now for a big corporation. The best procurement people are not procurement people typically. So we parachuted you in. You're a new CPO in a big company, and you've been tasked with ensuring that your supply chains are gender equal. Where do you start? What do you do in the first 100 days?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I guess if I was a product-based company, I'd go to the factories first, because I always believe you start at the bottom for fairness, you help everyone, and you help the people who need it the most. So I wouldn't be worrying about the educated middle-class white women in my company. I'd be worrying about the women with the least power. So I would institute, would join one of these groups that does gender measurements in the factories. And then I would ask all my regular vendors, the ones with which we have big spends, I would ask them all to report on gender or look them up in my procurement platform to see how their score is. And I'd go over that with them and I'd say, you know, we spend, what do you say, $50 million with you every year, and you don't really match our company in terms of values. And I know you can't get there immediately, but you could make some progress. And I would encourage them to make progress and then have a vacation, I think.
You would have earned it. Yeah, that's a brilliant answer.
And then I would tell everyone in the organization, do the same thing. It's like, we maybe can't go fix the factories, but we can all ask in our daily lives. You can ask where the coffee comes from. We can ask if the coffee shop is owned by a woman or an underrepresented population. And we can ask these questions and just start thinking about where our stuff comes from. Are we putting our money in places that we like how they're run? But I love the idea that I would have all this money and power, though. That was
You've got an infinite budget. Jonathan signs the checks around here, not me. Yeah, scroll back a little bit then. You touched on measurement just slightly. How can organizations measure how well they're doing in terms of gender equality in the supply chain?
again, for factories, you can go to these international programs that exist, ISARW, and you can use those. But in terms of regular products, my gender fair will show you which companies do well. We have an app and people can look up a company name. I think it works in Europe. And so you could punch in HP or Logitech and it would say, oh, it has a great score on gender. They have about 2,500 brands. But if not, if you wanting to buy from a company that is not on an index, you could look at their leadership page and see how many women are high leaders. You could ask if they do philanthropy for women. We use a measurement that's run by the UN Women Empowerment Principles that was created by the UN. It's called the Women Empowerment Principles, and it looks at things like leadership and employment policies, fair pay. It looks at diversity reporting. It looks at, you know, support of women in the community. So that sort of holistic measurement is how we look at a company guided by the UN. So you can ask companies all these different questions about how they support women in many ways.
Before we came to do this today, I've got to confess I felt a little bit nervous at the topic, really, at talking about this. And the question I have, Amy, is should men talk about gender equality?
That's when it has meaning. After years of doing this work, I realized that the most progress we've made with gender fair is when a very powerful man in a company takes it on and realizes that he has the power to make real change. Like, women often don't have the power in these large corporations to do that. And if they do, they sort of feel singled out. So I love it when men talk about this, and there are benefits for everyone. It's not a zero-sum game. And the smart CEOs realize this, like the CEO of Logitech was just brilliant and let them start this coalition for gender fair procurement and supported it. So yes, we want more men talking about it, and gender equality in home will make your lives better. Gender equality makes everything better. So yes, please keep on being champions for us. And I hope today we'll bring on some new male champions that will think like, I have the power to take this kind of action. I can change some procurement processes in my company. I can ask these questions. I have a $1 billion budget. I spend a lot of money. People listen to me. I have moral importance. Much easier to act from a position of power.
It's so good to hear you say that, because what you've just done is you've given me and you've given all of the men listening permission to go and do this. Now, that might sound a bit odd, but what I hope coming out of this podcast is that a lot of the people that are sitting listening to this thinking, hey, I can do this. Actually, I've got it within my gift to think about a program to start looking at some of this stuff. So, you know, it almost felt like there was permission to go and do that. And maybe it's kind of, well, why did we not do it before? I don't know. But, you know, I really hope that that does trigger some change as a result of this.
How do you encourage organizations that really are trying their best but not achieving? And I can give a genuine example to that. I'm the vice chair of a regional chamber of commerce. And we've got a board of some 14 individuals, some fairly powerful business people in the region. And of that board, we've only got two women board members, which is not very good. But the frustration is the door is open. The door has always been open to applicants to be part of our board. But for some reason, people aren't walking through that door to put their CV down and actually come forward. Are we doing something wrong?
Well, I have an easy answer. You have to be intentional about it. And just leaving the door open isn't enough. That's when you need a barker saying, you know, free board seats inside, and you tap people who are outside of your industry. I mean, they may not want to put their names down because they do see that it's a majority older male group and they think they're not welcome.
That's the old, thank you very much.
Actually, I was thinking about the Rotary Club. Someone told me recently that her Rotary Club was just all these older white men. She was a young woman of color. She said, I don't feel comfortable there.
Yeah,
so there's a Chamber of Commerce in the city I live outside Toronto. And this gentleman made it the most diverse Chamber of Commerce in Canada. But he did it intentionally. So he went out and sought people and told them he wanted their feedback. So I think it's just a little bit more activity. Just find a few women in your community and ask them to join the board. I bet they would. And they'd be happy to do it. We're humans. Inertia. We don't seek out change. We don't do new things. You have to really make an effort to do something.
Good points and good point of encouragement there. So I'd like to bring the final question, which I'm sure we'll all agree is a very important question. That's the subject of takeaways.
Yes.
This weekend will be my birthday weekend at the time of recording. So I'm going to indulge in a Chinese takeaway because I do like that. But with regards to some facts, indicators and suggestions and ideas, Amy, what are your three top takeaways?
I love that question because, you know what, I like talking about action because I find most people don't talk about it. So I wrote mine down and I'm going to look at them right now. Realize that as a customer, you have power to make vendors do better. Like, you really do have this power and you can use it. 2, take action immediately, just in all your spending. Find women and minority-owned businesses you can buy from in your neighborhood as well, not just your professional procurement budget. And then my third one, of course, is take the gender fair assessment and see how your company does. It's online, it's fast, it's easy, an hour, and it's half an hour, and you can get a gender score and immediate recommendations and observations. Or join our Coalition for Gender Fair Procurement, which we're all working together to see if we can do this better.
And the website's genderfair.com, is that right?
Yes. So there's also a site for the procurement. There's a gender site, Coalition for Gender Fair Procurement, which talks about this movement of procurement, which was led by a few different companies. We just facilitate it.
Excellent.
And I recommend you check it out and sign up for that assessment. Amy Cross, it's been a delight and a pleasure to have you on The Procurement Show. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. I loved it.
You've been listening to The Procurement Show. Contact us by email, hello@theprocurementshow.com. Connect with us on LinkedIn, search for The Procurement Show, and on Twitter, @ProcurementShow. Visit us at theprocurementshow.com. The Procurement Show is brought to you by Positive Purchasing, enabling the future of procurement in organizations around the globe. Copyright Positive Purchasing, all rights reserved. Produced by Fresh Air Studios.